Francine W. from Los Angeles. Hi, my name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. And, wow, it's wonderful to look out here and see all of you. I want to first thank the committee for asking me to be a part of this conference. We've been trying to make this happen for a while, and I'm so glad that it finally did. I am really so grateful. You know, I'm kind of amazed, too. I know so many of you. I mean, I know you from different conferences. I know you from L.A. I know you from all over the place. I know you from Washington, from all over. One of my former sponsees from New York was here, Whitney. And I guess she left. I sponsored her long enough. But it's really, really fabulous to be in here. The only thing I have to tell you that I do not like is I thought you guys might have treated the speaker a little better. I was sitting back there waiting to win. Waiting to win. I knew that I had won. I was going to give up the television, but I thought I'd win Vegas. I mean, I knew you were going to just give it to me, and the number was so close, I want you to know. That's okay. It was a great basket you gave me, though. I want you to know. Thank you so much. And I have the lotion from that lovely basket that the committee gave me. Whoa, it is such a pleasure to be here. Such a pleasure. God. I just have to tell you that, you know, when I first got sober, probably like some of you in here today, I did not like women. It was not a comfortable experience for me to be in a room with one other woman, let alone 400, you know. And one of the true gifts of my recovery has been change. It's been change. And now I get to come to a room with a lot of women and my heart just blooms. You know, it is so fabulous to be in a room with sisters. And see, I see you that way. I see. However you may see me is another story. But I see you today as my sisters. I see you today as my anchors. And let me pour one cry. Coming up on 44 years old, I still do not know how to cut it off. But my heart is so open here because it's you who taught me how to be the woman that you see before you. And for that, I am so grateful. So grateful. Thank you. I had the privilege, thanks, of going to several of the workshops today. And wow. You know, just starting off with the one about thine own self, to thine own self be true. You know, what you'll hear from me, especially in the last few years of my sobriety, is just about that. My story is a story of hope and inspiration for anybody who wants a piece of it. You know, it's there for the plucking. And you taught me how to my own self be true. And that's not the woman I came in here as, I can truly tell you that. But today I am. The workshop on mothers and daughters, I sat in on that. And, you know, my relationship with my mother is very different. Throughout my story, what you will hear are things. What I hope you will hear are how I've changed from this place to this place with regard to every area of my life. And I need you to know that some of you might not agree with what I say. Some of you might not be in the place where I'm at today. Some of you might not be able to hear it. And that's really okay. We are where we are, and I want you to know that I appreciate that we are all in the place where we are today. But there will be some things I'm sure that some of you won't like, because I'm in a very different place at 17 years of sobriety than I was at 1 year, or 5 years, or 10 years, or even a year ago. I am very different. But I hope that if you are looking for a reason to not identify with me, let me first say, if you are looking for a reason not to identify, you will find it. Easily. If you want a reason to say, I'm not going to connect with her, number one, there are not that many black women sitting in this audience, so if you're anything other than black, you've got a reason right there. You know? And if you are over 43 or under 43, there's another excuse if you'd like to identify out. And I live in L.A. What can I say? It's like just me, maybe one other. You know, but I can also say that if your heart is just a little open, if there's just a tiny opening, and that's all that's required. If you want to connect with anything I have to say this afternoon, I will give you plenty. I will give you plenty. Because the woman that speaks to you today is truly a woman that comes to you with an open heart. And I want, in my prayers today, what I ask God for is the ability to touch as many as possible. And there was a time when I didn't care about that. I alienated 3/4 of the room, and that was just okay. Thank you. And today it's not like that. You know. So, anyway, I am so glad to be here. So very, very glad. I feel like a little girl, you know. Even though I'm wearing high heels, I'm still, like, kind of peeking over. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, 43 years ago. And I don't remember an awful lot about those early days of my life. And I don't know if it's because I drank and used so much that the brain cells have been destroyed, which I must tell you is possible. I'm a product of the 60s, and I drank and used drugs in massive quantities. Or maybe I don't remember a lot about what happened because at 17 years of sobriety, I'm still in a state of denial. Or what I've chosen to believe today, which is probably the reason I don't remember a lot of those little details, is because this God, this most sweet God, this most loving God that I've come to believe in since I've been here in Alcoholics Anonymous, just hasn't seemed fit for me to remember a lot of things. Maybe had I remembered one more itsy-bitsy detail, I might have been tipped over the edge. I might have gotten the courage that I wanted to take my own life. But you see, God wanted me here for some reason. I don't know. Maybe it was for that one woman who's sitting in the back of the room this afternoon. That one woman who just needs to see and hear in the flesh that you can get from point A to point C through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That no matter how far down the scale you go, you can become like the phoenix that rises from the ashes. That no matter how dirty you may feel right at this moment, no matter how used and humiliated and abused you have been or you feel, that there's a way out of that. And maybe that's the reason that I'm here. But I don't remember a lot of that stuff, but I can tell you what I do remember mostly about growing up as a child in the South is that I hurt all the time. I hurt all the time. I had the same kind of pain I heard a lot of you share today. That pain that goes really deep, that goes really deep down to the core of who I am. I hated who I was being black. I hated who I was being a girl. I hated who I was being a southerner. If you can possibly imagine, I used to have a very strong southern accent. Very strong. And, I mean, they used to make fun of me and laugh at me and call me down in the cornfields. I grew up in the South, and they hurt me a lot when I was growing up. And as a kid, I didn't have the kind of ammunition that I have today, the kind of spiritual ammunition that says that doesn't matter. As a child, I hurt. My soul ached, my body hurt. I hated being different, and yet even though I was with people who were like me, I still felt different, if you can imagine that. You know, I still felt different. It was always like there was a party going on somewhere, and I was on the outside desperately wanting to become a part of the party. That's all I ever wanted. All I ever wanted. I didn't want to be better than you until later. I came years later. You know? Those early days, I just wanted to be on level with you. I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of the group. And I never could. I was like that round peg in a square hole. I never just quite fit. And you know, there was a wonderful television movie that was on about 6, 7, 8 years ago, and I don't even remember now. But I often like to allude to this when I talk because better than anything I could tell you about how I felt about myself growing up as a child, this movie explains it. There was the movie was Separate But Equal, and it was about the former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's efforts to effectuate some kind of change in this country. It was about the Brown v. Board of Education case in 1954, which ultimately integrated schools in the United States. And in this TV movie, they were trying to understand the impact of segregation on little, small children. So they had a big room, and they had all these kids in the room. And they just asked them a battery of questions, one question after another. But there was nothing complicated. There were no trick questions. They just asked them simple questions. And they came to this little black girl, and she was just there by herself. And they brought her over. And in responding to each question, each one of the kids had to choose one of four little dolls that was sitting in front of them. There's a little black boy doll, a little white boy doll, a little black girl doll, and a little white girl doll. And they brought this little black girl over, and they simply asked her to pick out the ugly doll of the four dolls in front of her. It wasn't a trick question at all. They just said, pick out the ugly doll that you see out of those four. And I can tell you without blinking her eye, Without hesitating for a moment, she grabbed a hold of the doll that looked exactly like herself. Not like you, not like you, not like anybody else. She grabbed a hold of the doll that looked exactly like herself. Because for her, when she looked at herself in the mirror, that was the ugliest person she could imagine. Her own image. And I can tell you, I was sober a long time when I saw that movie. I mean, 9, 10 years, something like that. But it took me back to my childhood like nothing else had up until that point. It was so painful for me. I couldn't stop sobbing as I looked at this little kid do that, because that's exactly the place where I came from. Well, when I looked at myself in the mirror, the image I saw back was not the image I wanted to see. I wanted to see anybody other than me. And I can tell you, that was evidenced by the fact that as a child, my earliest escape in life came through books and movies. And my favorite women characters were Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. That's who I wanted to look like. I didn't want to look like me. You know, I love those really tough women. They were fabulous because as a kid, I was nothing. I had nothing. I had no core inside. I was just this poor little black kid who moved from the South and ultimately moved to the South Bronx in New York and hated who she was. And when I watched Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, it was like, yes. You know, for a moment, I felt empowered. And it was the same way with the books. I loved books. My mother is a librarian. We used to have lots and lots of books in my house, all over the place. In every room, on every wall, there were like reams and reams of books. And I wasn't a smart kid at all, but sometimes I'd take a book off the shelf and I'd just go sit in the corner by myself and, you know, I'd try to read. And I wasn't really good at reading, but I knew that once I opened up the, you know, between those binders, there was something magical that took place for me. And it was only temporary, but it worked for a little while. And it was the same way with those movies. You know, I'm sometimes embarrassed when I say it, but it's the truth. I learned a lot about who I am as a female by watching Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Susan Hayward. That's very true. I don't smoke cigarettes anymore, but I smoked 3 packs of Cool Filters for 16 very, very, very long years. And I learned by watching Betty Davis in All About Eve. It's so true. I'll never forget when she's ascending the staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder, puffing those circles, talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. Had she only known. Had she only known. And I'd stand in the mirror sometimes as a kid and I'd puff circles and choke. And puff and choke. And for anybody who started smoking, you know, I mean, most of us don't get it right away. We have to practice and practice, and practice makes perfect. And eventually I was a good smoker, you know. But I learned that by watching them. And same thing with drinking. I still have a tendency to hold my glass with my pinky stuck out. And I learned that by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. Backstreet. I learned some other things by watching her in Backstreet, too, I must tell you. But that was one of them. I learned how to hold my glass. And as a little girl, we used to have a full-length mirror in our apartment in New York. And this is very embarrassing, but it is very true. I'd stand in the mirror and do this Betty Davis strut. I swear to God. You know, and all that really says, for anybody who's reasonably healthy in here, is that I was a kid who hated who I was. You know, all the laughter, all that other stuff is one thing. But the sad reality is I wanted to be anybody other than Francine. I just didn't want to be me. I couldn't stand being me. I used to use razor blades to try to scrape off my skin. And I would use bleaching cream to try to take off my color because I hated being in this body. I just didn't want to be here. I used to pray to a God I didn't really believe in as a kid that I could just unzip my skin and step out. I just wanted to be somebody else. And so it wasn't difficult for anybody who saw me as a child in that kind of pain to eventually know that I was going to find a way out. A way out. And I can tell you, for a long time, the books and the movies worked, and then they simply stopped working. They simply stopped working. As most of us are sitting in here probably can attest to, those external things we use eventually fail us. And then once again, we're left with ourselves. And the books and movies stopped working, and what started to happen for me is, instead of taking me to another place, making me realize that I was someone special, the books and movies started to make it perfectly clear that this was my life, whether I liked it or not. That this was the hand I was dealt, and if I didn't like it, it was too bad. And I can't stand up here and tell you on a conscious level I then decided I was going to just run right out and use drugs and alcohol because that was just too much for me. But I do believe in my gut that the realization of that fact, that this was all there was so great for people that I loved drugs. I knew drugs and booze wouldn't. And I'm a product of the 60s, so it was truly about better living through chemistry. You know? I grew up in New York City, and it was about using chemicals to come up, using chemicals to come down, using chemicals to level you off. Truly, I am an example of someone who has survived the war. Because as many chemicals as I've put in my body, my little body, there's no reason I should be standing here. You know, I often hear relative newcomers today come and talk about lines. I didn't have a clue what a line was. When I was getting high, there were bowls of drugs. And we used to use those big straws, and we used to wear spoons around our necks. And my nails have always been long, you know. And today, the hair in my nose still hasn't grown back, you know. Because I kept doing it. I kept doing it. I drank as much as I could. I used as much as I could. And I would still be doing it if I could do it. But I couldn't. I couldn't. I became the kind of woman alcoholic who was vile and who was wretched. I'd like to tell you that I was a dainty drinker. I'd like to... Dainty, not daily. Dainty, I'd like to tell you that. I'd like to tell you that I was at all times social. But the sad reality for someone like me who started out coming from a place of self-loathing and then just poured drugs and alcohol on top of it, it was not a pretty picture. It was not a pretty picture. I remember when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I read in the big book those words, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I can tell you there is not one single person who was here when I got sober who had to sit me down and say, Francine, let's explain to you what this means. You know? There was not one person who had to say, we want to tell you what it feels like to be a woman who is pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. Nobody had to tell me what that was about. I knew what it felt like to feel dirty all over all the time. I knew what it felt like to compromise myself as a woman to the point that I didn't even realize what I was doing was a compromise. I knew what it felt like to sell my soul. I knew what it felt like to settle for seconds in everything, in men, in jobs, in everything, because I never thought I was good enough to get the real thing. I knew what it felt like to just settle. And there were times when I'd come home from doing whatever it was I was doing out in the streets of New York, and I'd stand under the shower, and the water would just beat down my body. And sometimes I'd scrub, and I'd get abrasions on my skin because I'd scrub so hard trying to take the dirt off. And for those of you in here that are real alcoholics, you know the kind of dirt I'm talking about. The kind you think comes off with soap and water, but it doesn't. The kind that's so deeply embedded that it just doesn't come off with soap and water. And I'd scrub, and it wouldn't come off. I'd use fragrance to try to cover it up, and it wouldn't hide the stench. Because, you know, like when you put toxins in the ground, eventually they seep through. Well, it was the same thing. The dirt was deep down inside of me, so I'd put fragrance on, but me kept coming through. Or I'd wear pretty clothes thinking, you know, I could cover it up. Or the biggest thing for me was I was always attached to the right man. See, I always found guys who were supposedly pillars of society. So that made me feel like I was somebody. And by the end of my recovery, it was really easy to find that. I mean, I grew up very, very poor in the South and in the South Bronx. But eventually I found a way out of the poverty. And I found men who were more than willing to spend lots and lots and lots of money on me. The sad reality is what I eventually had to do to get all those things that I got, you know, today I know it was not about dignity, but when I was doing it, it was okay because I got to have a diamond here, I got to travel there, I got to do all those things I thought I wanted to do, but the price was so high. And, you know, every time I'd do something that was vile or despicable, it would chink away at that, what little bit of self-esteem I had. So when I was standing in the shower trying to wipe that stuff off, it could never come off because it was so deeply embedded down here. And I didn't learn until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous that the cleansing process had to start from in here. That it wasn't about the outside. It wasn't about all those pretty clothes. It was how I behaved as a woman. It was how I behaved as a woman. And I heard so much of that today. I heard so much pain this afternoon surrounding how we behave as women. And I just need to say for myself that that I learned in the years that I am sober, even though I wanted to blame those men for giving me all that money, for forcing me to take those diamond rings, for just tying me down and giving me yet another lynx coat. You know, I realized after all was said and done, it was about my choices. It was about my choices as a woman. And when I learned that no was a complete sentence all by itself, I started to get healthy one day at a time. But I can tell you, it didn't happen for a long time. And you know, the irony of this program is anything you are going through or have going through in recovery, there's someone who's following you who you can be of service to. You know, I have two women in my life right now that I sponsor who have gone that same path. And you know, I understand, because I've gone the whole gamut, I understand that it doesn't happen overnight that you change. This program only asks us to make a beginning if we want to get to a different place. And we don't even have to make that beginning. It's really important to understand that too. You don't have to do anything in here if you don't want to. But for this alcoholic, it got to a point where I was going to die if I continued to behave the way I was behaving. I was going to die. In 1978, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't get sober because I didn't think I had a problem. And that is such a joke. I didn't think I had a problem. I was drinking every day. I came to in the morning with the bottle in my mouth. I passed out at night with the bottle in my mouth. I had drugs all day, and yet I didn't think I had a problem. And I guess part of that was because, see, my conception of an alcoholic was that old man down in the Bowery, the one with the overcoat and the bottle hanging out of the back of his pocket with those popping veins out of his face. That was an alcoholic. And if by chance it was a woman, well, Susan Hayward. I mean, I was a movie buff. Susan Hayward digging out of a garbage can and I'll cry tomorrow. That was an alcoholic woman. That was not me. No. And yet, you know, alcoholism is truly a disease of perception. I learned that since I've been here. I learned that if I want to, I can identify out. If I want to think something doesn't apply to me, it's so easy to do it. I was the first to tell you, but I never dug in the garbage can. And yet how quickly I had forgotten those many, many, many days when I was digging in the garbage can for cigarette butts because I couldn't get a cigarette. And the cigarette butt would be all the way down to the quick, practically. And I'd be smoking and puffing, burning my lips, burning my fingers, but I was digging in the garbage. Or if the after-hour spot was closed or I just was too wasted to get up and go, I dig in the bottom of the garbage can for the little booze in the corner of the bottle. You know? Or those old glasses, like after a party when you see booze left with cigarettes in them. You know, I'd love to tell you it wasn't me. You know? I would like to stand up here and tell you with this much dignity today, it wasn't me. I wasn't there, but I was. I came from that place, and yet, you know, when I remember when I was newly sober, I conveniently forgot all that stuff. I forgot every inappropriate act I performed as a woman. I just forgot. I just forgot. And so I had to stick around here long enough to remember. But at the end of my drinking, I got hit by a car in a blackout in 1978. I came into AA in New York, and then I moved out to Las Vegas, Nevada, what you've taught me is a geographic. I didn't even know what that word meant when I came in here. And I moved out to Vegas. That's why I wanted that ticket so badly. I wanted to go, but I moved out to Vegas in search of my pot of gold. And if any of you are like me, probably not, you guys probably aren't, probably a little healthier, but I was one of those people who thought, if you move from point A to point C, you leave all your baggage at point A. I really believe that. It didn't dawn upon me that when I left New York, I was going to Vegas too. All of me, you know. And it did. I took all of my baggage with me to Las Vegas, Nevada. And it took all but 9 months for this most loving God to do what I could never have done for myself. I got hit by a car in a blackout in June of 1979, and to date, I say that God broke my leg in order to save my life. And I truly believe that. Because the way I was headed, there's no way in the world I would have ever gotten sober of my own volition. I couldn't. I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop drinking. My life was surrounded by booze and drugs. I needed it to survive. I couldn't stop drinking. And I got hit by the car, and it took me a month and a half before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because I just didn't think I belonged here. I mean, again, it's that the disease of perception. I got hit by a car. I was drunk. but I didn't think I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a month and a half later, I came in here. I'd like to tell you that I'd like to just share with you my last drunk. Not because it was my worst, but because clearly it was the way I thought. I come from the doctor. I had a cast all the way up my thigh. My whole leg was broken. When they found me in the streets first on Paradise Road, which is the street where I live, in a direction opposite from my house. And when they found me, they didn't think I was going to live. And when they realized I was going to live, they never thought I'd ever walk again because my left leg had come up behind my head and the bone had come straight through. And I limp today, and it's not something I can hide. I walk with a limp. I have a 10-inch scar in my leg that I don't hide. I wear short skirts and shorts. It's about 10 inches with a lot of hole marks in it as a reminder of where I've come from, those good old days. You know, a reminder of the price I had to pay to stand before you this afternoon. But that, you know, anybody who's a real deal alcoholic knows that no mere car accident is going to stop you if you're on a mission. And it didn't. It didn't. Again, I continued to drink for another month and a half. And then what happened for me is what I choose to think was that moment of clarity. That moment where, and I don't know why it happened on this particular day, I came to and I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And that was it. I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. And I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to share with you my last drunk before I picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. I come to in this apartment that had the potential of being simply beautiful. I lived in a complex in Las Vegas called Las Palmas, and it was gorgeous. It was 22 acres of palm trees all over the place. It was really, really pretty. And there was a little brook right outside of my garden apartment, and they used to keep little ducklings inside, and it was so lovely. I mean, any reasonably healthy person would have appreciated that. It was just a really pretty place. And inside my apartment, again, it had the potential of being nice, but it wasn't. When you walked into my apartment, you were smacked in the face by the stench of animal waste and human waste. Because at the end of my drinking, I could not take care of myself or my animals. I couldn't do it. I didn't mean to treat them like I did. I didn't mean to treat myself like I did. But I couldn't help it. I just couldn't help it. And on this particular night, I had come from the doctor, and the doctor hadn't taken off my cast. And as had always been my pattern, I showed you when I didn't get what I wanted. And I remember coming from the doctor's office, stopping by the liquor store with whoever it was that brought me home, and I should have known that the end was near. Now, this is not a negative against anybody who drank this. It just wasn't my drink of choice. But I should have known the end was near when I ended up picking up 3 bottles of Blue Nun. To each his own. It's just not what I drank. And sometimes, even today, when I think of Blue Nun, I think of vinegar. You know, I kind of think of that. Can't amount of vinegar. But I should have known. I picked up 3 big bottles. I didn't even know they had these huge bottles. And I drank all 3. And the next thing I recall was about 3-4 o'clock in the morning. It was in the wee hours. I came to in this apartment that really had the potential of being lovely. I came to in this apartment with stucco walls and wood paneled walls and wall-to-wall carpeting, with my crutches on one side of the room, my door wide open, and I was laying in my own waste on the carpet. You know, and I never, ever want to forget that image. Because you see, that's not who I am today. That's not how I smell. That's not how I behave. That's not how I treat myself or my animals. But it's so important to me never to forget that that's where I wound up at the very end. Because you see, being sober as long as I'm sober today and having my life change as drastically as it has changed in 17 years, it becomes really easy to forget where I've come from. It becomes easy to say, oh, I don't need to go to meetings. I'm sober long enough. Or, I don't need to be doing service. Let those newcomers do it. They need to get sober. Or it becomes easy to say, I don't want to go to that meeting with those people. Or I don't want to sponsor that kind of woman. It becomes really easy for me to forget where I've come from. It becomes really easy to forget. So one day at a time, I'm reminded of the price I had to pay to stand before you this afternoon. I called up Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas about 5 days later, and I remember vaguely that there was a woman on the phone. I don't remember much of anything else except she said she couldn't get anybody to me at that moment. And if I could just hold on for another day, she'd have somebody come and pick me up and take me to a meeting. And I believe that this God that I've only come to believe in since I've been sober knew I wasn't going to last another 24 hours. And so I got a telephone call from a woman who lived in the complex literally next door to mine. And she said, "Francine, if you'd like to go to a meeting, I'd be happy to take you." And I pray to God that that was my last first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. I pray to God I never have to go out and find out whether I'd make it back here. Because you see, I'm one of those people who does not believe I'd make it back. That's just for me. Not only do I believe that I do not have another recovery, I believe I do not have another full drunk. Because you see, I had a really bad mouth when I was drinking. I mean, a really, really bad mouth. I mean, guys used to smack me. I'd be up in big guys' faces, and they'd knock me down, and I'd be back up in their faces with a little bit more booze. And now, with a little sobriety and some booze in my belly, oh, God only knows what would happen to me. You know? But the sadder reality is that, you know what? I'd probably take my own life. Because there's no way I'd want to live having been sober as long as I've been sober, knowing what I know, and then having to come back as a newcomer. You know? I couldn't deal with it. I know I couldn't. And since I don't want to find out, one day at a time, I do what it takes to stay right here. I do what it takes to stay right here close to you guys. Because I'm too scared to find out. One of the very first women role models I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was one of the first women I ever heard speak at a conference that I identified with. I was about a year and a half sober. Excuse me. She was a circuit speaker all over the country. And she went out at 16 years of sobriety, which was about 3 years ago. And she came back for a year, and she's been out on heroin ever since. And she lives in my area, down in Southern California. And you know, every now and then I hear about her, and I see her, and it breaks my heart, because this is a woman whose tape you can buy. I mean, she was one of the first women who ever gave me the permission to come from the place where I came from and yet not be in that place anymore. And yet she's still out there. And so I know that if I get too far off this AA beam, I know where I can be. I know where I can be. So one day at a time, I stay close. One day at a time, over the years, I become willing to do the undoable. The undoable. I got sober in July of 1979, and I'd love to tell you that I came in here and embraced this program with open arms. You know, I'd like to tell you I was the perfect little Miss AA who came in here and just, you know, yes, yeah, sponsor, you know. I've always had a bad attitude. It's truly only of late that it's changed, and it's only changed because of my willingness to not give up, to not give up on myself. I've continually been willing to do the work. But when I came in here, I was scared. I was scared, and people thought I was really angry. And you know, I guess outwardly it was anger, but inside it was nothing but fear. I was a street kid from New York, and I was tough. I was really tough, and I had a wall around me so thick I wouldn't let you in, and I wouldn't let me out. Don't you dare show me you care. Because you see, people weren't to be trusted. I knew what that was like. I grew up in the streets. You can't trust anyone. You don't dare let them see you vulnerable. I mean, I only learned how to cry in AA, and unfortunately now I can't cut it off, but I would have never let anybody see me cry. Ever. Ever. You know, but I came in here and I hurt so badly. I hurt so badly. I used to sit on the side of the room with the people who said, "Honey, all you have to do is come in here and take up a seat, and you're going to get it through osmosis." Well, I am very grateful for the sponsor that I had who didn't believe that. I found her early. And she believed, and first let me just say, if you're new and you don't know what osmosis means, simply put, it means if you sit next to someone who's sober and rub up against them, you're going to catch it like that. You're going to catch sobriety. Osmosis means absorption. It's a scientific term, and you'll catch it. And you see, I wanted to believe that. I wanted to believe that I wasn't required to do any work, because that's always been my M.O. I wanted this much benefit, always, and I wanted to do about this much work to get it. I have never been a worker. It's only today that I'm different. But I came in here lazy and sitting back waiting for him to fix me. And there were always hymns. Always hymns. I lived very well. There were always hymns. But I chose people who were like me to be around. You know, I'd hang out, and I came in here just really angry all the time, angry and fearful. And I came across the sponsor, and she was so incredible. She was one of those people who said, if you want what we have, you do what we do. She said, it wasn't a mistake that in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's an entire chapter called Into Action. And she said, more than that, it's not a mistake that in that chapter, you're going to find most of our 12 steps discussed, steps 5 through 11. And she said, in that chapter, you're going to find the promises, Into Action, the Into Action chapter. And she said to me, if you want the promises that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, then it's to your advantage, Francine, to get into action. And I can tell you, that was as alien a thought as I can possibly tell you. You know, Into Action, I mean, this woman only talked about action, gratitude, service, and God. And those were all concepts that I did not like. I didn't believe in God. Service, well, it was how they could serve me, you know. And I got paid for it. I know. Action, well, that we didn't even think about. And gratitude, well, there was no reason to be grateful. Grateful. I mean, I was out there living in the streets, you know, a drunken woman, and then getting newly sober, feeling like a piece of crap. You're telling me I should be grateful. So it was really hard for me to resolve the issue of coming in here feeling wonderful about sobriety. But I kept sticking around. I kept sticking around. You know, I came in here and I didn't like men and I didn't like women. I didn't like anybody. And it was a surprise to most people that I didn't like men, I must tell you. I was one of those women who has never, ever, ever in my life been without a man until now. Ever. Before I got sober, I had never been without a man. And didn't have to. I mean, why should I have been without a man? That was my thinking. And yet when I came in, I realized how much I disliked men. I realized how much I blamed them, how it was their fault for why, just like I blamed my mother. It was her fault and it was their fault for why I was the way I was. And thank God for sobriety. You know, I just want to say to those of you that are new, this program offers you opportunities to get healthy. It just does. It offers you opportunities to heal if you are willing to do what is necessary. It doesn't always happen if you're not willing, but if you are willing, the sky opens up for you. And what happened for this alcoholic woman was the healing process took over because of my willingness to do certain things. And I can tell you today, men are among my best friends. Men are among my best friends, and part of that happened because of the wonderful men that I met when I was newly sober who didn't try to 13-step me. Who did not try to 13-step me. I got to see healthy examples of men in Alcoholics Anonymous who just wanted to help me get sober. That was it. But what I found more than disliking the men was that I despised women when I first came here. I really, really hated women. And it wasn't so much that I hated you, it was that I was so jealous of what you had. You know, and I was just so afraid. I was so afraid. And thank God for the women who had the courage to see past my tough exterior, who'd come and hug me even though I'd sneer and push them back. You know, they just had the courage to be there for me. The other people's husbands, the ones who were doing healthy things, I couldn't stand them because, you see, I was still doing all that stuff. I was still sleeping with other people's husbands at 2 years sobriety. I was still sleeping with other people's boyfriends at 2 years sobriety. I was still acting like a whore at 2 years sobriety. And so how could I want to hear, why would I possibly want to hear women who are in a different place than me? A healthy place. But that sponsor of mine was incredible. I got sponsored with a woman who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. That self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. Louise said to me, if you act like a whore, you will be treated like a whore. If you dress like a hooker, you're going to be treated like a hooker. She said, if every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, then don't be surprised if that's the message you get back. She taught me self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And I can tell you, there's not one single woman that's sitting in here this afternoon that would ever have to worry about me in the room with her man. There's not one of you. And that's a big thing for someone who's come from the place I've come from. There's not one of you. Number one, because for me, it's an esteemable act not to sleep with someone else's spouse. That's for me. But also, as I've gotten healthier in recovery, I realize I don't want to settle for seconds. I just don't. You know? I mean, I like my own, thank you. You know? I want my own. I want someone who can pay me all the attention that I know I deserve and want. And how can he pay me attention if he's paying you and you and you attention too? So, I know. And also, I'll tell you what's happened for me in the years I'm sober. I love women so much that I wouldn't do that to my sister. I just wouldn't do that to my sister. And that's where I'm at today. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. What Louise taught me, and she taught me in small doses because that's all I could handle at the time. And again, anything I share from this podium is how I work this program. It's not telling you what you need to be doing. So please understand that. But one day at a time, I choose not to use four-letter words. And that was a major deal for somebody like me. I came in here sounding like a sailor. Every other word out of my mouth was a four-letter word. And it wasn't because I didn't know too many other words, although I question that sometimes. You know, I really wasn't all that educated. The books I was reading were not the kind you learn really good words from. But I realized that I hated myself so much that when I would go into AA meetings and curse, people laughed. So I found that it was better to have negative reinforcement rather than no reinforcement at all. Because at least if you laughed when I said something, at least it reaffirmed that I was present. And when you hate yourself as much as I hated myself, that was important. Excuse me, that was really important to have. One day at a time, Louise taught me how not to curse. And it started small. It started by, instead of using 10 curse words in the sentence, I'd cut it down to 5 curse words. Then it was reduced to 2 curse words, and then maybe only 1 curse word in the sentence. And then maybe every other sentence had 1 curse word in it. And before I knew it, I wasn't using profanity, just for me. Before I knew it, I chose not to use it. Likewise, she also taught me that another esteemable act was that I stopped using negative words to describe myself. I heard a lot of that talked about this today. You know, one day at a time, I don't call myself bitch. I don't call myself poor. I don't call myself a lot of the things I used to call myself. And as a result, I don't dare let you do it. I don't dare let you do it. But that's something I had to learn. For a long time, I did. And I would say, oh, I'm only joking. Well, I don't joke that way with me. I don't joke that way with me. And it's been gradually that kind of behavior that has enabled me to feel empowered to be the woman that I am today. Because I stopped doing some things and I started doing other things. I dress today differently than when I came into sobriety. I got sober wearing hot pants up to my navel, truly, and blouses cut down to my navel, and I couldn't understand why people were looking at me so strange, you know? I mean, I didn't understand it. I did not get it. Everything was hanging out, but I did not get it. And I thought I was like the pussycat's meow, you know? And so one day at a time, I learned how to dress appropriately for the occasion. I wear shorts when I'm wearing shorts. When I'm speaking at a meeting, I wear something differently. When I'm in the office, I dress appropriately. But it's those little things that help me to be a different woman. Mostly, I learned that no was a sentence all by itself. I must tell you, I learned how to say no. You know, I used to sleep with men I did not want to sleep with because I was afraid to say no. I was afraid if I dare said no, they would hate me. Well, who the hell cares? You know? But I need to acknowledge that it didn't happen overnight. So for those of you in the room that are still taking that, I understand it. I know where you're at. And I took it for a long time. To tell you how sick I was, I remember years ago when I would be wearing my hot pants, I'd walk past construction sites in New York, and I did it purposely because their feedback was really important to me. Really important. And then when I got sober and I got a little bit healthy, their feedback wasn't important, but I was afraid to cross the street. I was afraid, what would these guys think? Because I didn't like the remarks they were making, but I was too afraid to cross over. And so I would continue to walk past them and just cringe. And then I got a little healthier and I started crossing the street. You know, but that took time. It took time. But the reality is for a long time, I wouldn't cross over for fear of what these people who I didn't even like would think of me. Sobriety is a process. It is a process. At 17 years of sobriety, I'm different than I was at a year, than I was at 10, than I was at 5, than I was last year. Because I continually am willing to do this work and I keep changing. And the gift for me this year is that I've been willing to to work at having my heart be even more open and inclusive of those people who are not in the place I'm in today. Because you know what happened for me at particular points in my sobriety is as I started to change, then I was really arrogant, thinking, well, you all should be where I'm at. You should be doing this. You shouldn't take that. Well, wait a second. How long did it take me to get to the place I'm at? So today, compassion is one of my key words. Compassion for you, my sisters, who may still be in abusive relationships. You know, I have scars on my body to prove where I've been. I have scars on my body because I know what it feels like to be abused. But today, I am not there. Today, I am not there. I cannot tell you the last time a man ever put his hands on me. I cannot tell you how long ago it was. It was a long time ago. And if God willing, one day at a time, if I continue on the path I'm on, there will not be another day that a man will put his hands on me in an abusive way. One day at a time. But I had to get to this place. I didn't come in like this. So for those of you that are out here that are in those relationships that are abusive, whether it's physical or emotional, you know, because when I stopped being beat up physically, I used to think it was acceptable that a man would talk to me like trash and treat me like crap and flirt in front of me. You know, I'm sitting with him and he'd be flirting with someone else. I would think, well, that's okay. That's how men are. Well, that's not okay. That's unacceptable behavior for a man that I'm with. But I need you to know if you're still in that place, it's okay. And if you keep showing up here and if you cling to those of us that have been there but are not there now, but are willing to be loving and guide you through it, you can too make it. You can too make it. Because I know there are many of you in here that are taking it. I know that. One day at a time, I choose not to take it. At 2 years sobriety, I was changing. All this stuff was happening, and the insides were changing, but the outsides were changing as well. And the sponsor who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts, she kept saying, Francine, you can do what you want to do in sobriety if you are willing to show up. If you are willing to walk through your fear. I used to sit back and say, oh, but I can't. I mean, my favorite words were can't and never. You know, I would sit back and say, but I can't do anything because I'm black. Poor me, I'm black. Therefore, I can't do anything. My other favorite one was, I'm a girl. I mean, poor me, I'm a girl. I can't do anything. I need to marry someone who's like that. I can't do it for myself. Or I'd use my past as an excuse for not functioning in this world. I had a colorful past, you know, and I was so ashamed when I got here. And, you know, I just knew I couldn't turn my life around because, poor me, look at where I've come from. They'll stop me. They'll get in my way. They'll prevent me from moving forward. And I can just say one day at a time, I am one of those women who has overcome the odds. And the odds are lodged right here. See, I believe the odds aren't out there. The odds consist of the mass that's between my ears that says to me on a consistent basis, I can't make it. I can't cut it. I'll never amount to anything, and life's over for me. So I might as well just go marry a man who's got what I want. And that's okay, too. You know, to marry a man that you want, who has what you want, I think that's fine, too. However, that doesn't mean I, you know, give up who I am to be with him. You know, that, I mean, for me, the healthiest place today, which is the place where I'm moving toward, is for me to be healthy and to attract the kind of man that I want that's healthy as well. But I kept thinking I couldn't do anything with my life, and I hated where I was. I was working in Las Vegas as a dice dealer. I was one of the first women dice dealers in a major strip hotel, and I hated what I was doing. I hated it, especially because here I was making a lot of money taking garbage from men on the other side of the table who used to pay me a lot more money. You know? It was awful. It was just, it was the worst. But I also hated it because I was newly sober. You know, I didn't know who I was or what was going on. I hated everything. But I kept showing up, and at 2 years sobriety, I made a decision to do the undoable. I went back to school. And that was a big deal for somebody like me. I was a high school dropout. And education had never, ever been important to me. And it didn't have to be. I mean, not one of my benefactors ever asked me if I had a degree. None of them wanted to know if I went to finishing school. You know, none of that was important. All that mattered was how I looked, how I performed. and whether they could take me anywhere, and they could. It's all that mattered. And I can tell you, up until that point, and my first 2 years of sobriety, it never mattered to me either. And then at 2 years sobriety, I realized I no longer wanted to be someone else's mistress. I no longer wanted to be an appendage on someone else's arm. For the first time in my whole life, I wanted to be a woman of substance. A woman who was more than a face or a body. A woman who had something in here to give. And so I went back to school. And I started to talk about going back to school in Las Vegas, and people laughed at me. They really made fun of me, most of them. They tried to discourage me. They said, Francine, why don't you try something easier? You know, you just really can't do that. I mean, all my life I've heard, don't reach for the moon, because you're going to only be disappointed. Reach for the top of the fence. You can handle that. But don't go for the moon. You're going to only be disappointed. And so I never believed that I could go for the moon. And so I'm here to tell any woman who wants to hear it this afternoon, any woman who might be like me, who's got a flicker of a flame inside, a little passion, who's a dreamer. Maybe there's somebody in here who's a dreamer and who wants to do something with their lives. Maybe it's a career goal. Maybe it's to have the courage to leave that unhealthy relationship. Maybe it's the courage to move to a new apartment, move to a new city. Who knows what it may be? But the courage to do something that you really want to do. My message today is go for it. My message is don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do it. Because you're going to always find people to tell you you can't. Right here at AA. You don't even need to go outside of the room. You know? And that's just the way it is. You know, I came in and I talked about it and they tried to discourage me, but I can tell you what I realized is most of them, it wasn't that they just wanted not to see me succeed. Most of them loved me so much that they knew someone who had come from where I had come from could never do this thing. I mean, they knew that this was such a high and lofty goal that if I even made an effort and failed, I'd drink again. And you see, they wanted me sober more than they wanted me doing anything else. But I can tell you what I also realized, and this is just for me, and this is the way I like to put it. I like to say that you can't go to hardware stores and get oranges. You know, I went to people who themselves were living in fear, expecting them to encourage me out of the fear. And they couldn't do it. I went to men and women who hated where they were at. They hated their jobs. I went to women who hated being mothers, who hated being in their relationships, who hated everything about their lives. How could they encourage me to walk through my own fear? They couldn't walk through their own. I went to men who likewise felt the same, who hated being in their jobs, but felt, well, you know, you're a guy, you just have to deal with it. They hated what they were doing, didn't have the courage to move outside of that fear, so they couldn't encourage me outside of mine. But thank God for that sponsor who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. Louise said, the sky is the limit if you are willing to show up. And so one day at a time, I started on this journey, and I first had to get my high school diploma because what I wanted to do required a lot of education. So I got my high school diploma in Nevada in 1981. I had been out of school for 10 years. So if there's anybody in here thinking it was an easy journey, think again. And then it took me 10 years to reach the goal. So we're talking about a long time. But I went back to school and it was so hard. And it was hard again because of that mask between my ears. I kept saying I couldn't cut it. I was too old. I wasn't smart enough. I mean, my brain was working overtime, constantly trying to malign me, making me feel like I couldn't cut it. But you know what? All while it was talking, my feet were smart, and they just kept walking. One foot in front of the other. Because I had a sponsor who believed that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts, and going back to school for this alcoholic was an esteemable act. Walking through the fear was an esteemable act. I went to UNLV my first year, which is the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and then I moved back to New York City because what I wanted to pursue I couldn't do in Vegas, and plus I didn't want to live in Vegas anymore. I wanted to go back home. And so I put myself through college. I worked full-time. I went to meetings every day, and I took a full-time load in school. I carried 15, 16 credits, had a full-time job, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And I just need you to know that, you know, God help the sponsees that have ever come to me who thought they could get away with not going to meetings. You know? You know, it just didn't work. You know, because I know the importance of that, and it's really important for me when I share always to stress the part about going to meetings, because all too often I sit in AA meetings with people between those delicate years of 1 and 5 who are back in life. They have the right relationship, they have the right job, they're back in school, and nobody has time to go to meetings. And I've seen more people drink because they've been overloaded, because they forgot what their primary purpose was. And as much as I hated it, I kept showing up in meetings. I kept showing up because my sponsor reminded me that the only reason I was sitting in a classroom was because I was sober. She never let me forget that the only reason I could read a book when I could barely read was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what she also reminded me of was that I had a responsibility to pass on the message of hope and inspiration. That now that I was changing my life, I had a responsibility to share it with you guys. And if I needed to share it with you, that meant I needed to be where you were in AA meetings. So I shared about it, and I went to meetings, and I hated it. I grudgingly went to AA meetings, but I was there. And thank God, because when the time came for me to really need you, you were there for me, because I kept showing up. And the time came shortly thereafter. It came. Because of time, let me just tell you that it took 10 years for me to follow this dream, and I became a lawyer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just... Thank you. That is your victory as much as mine, because people like me don't get to be where I am, but for Alcoholics Anonymous. Truly women who have come from the places I've come from don't get to show up like I get to show up, but for you guys. This doesn't happen. You know, and I remember when I was first admitted to the bar, I remember having a case in criminal court in New York, and it was so incredible. I cried inside. I wouldn't dare let the tears flow outside. But I was standing in there defending someone else, and I had been in that very same court years before, arrested. That very same court. And it was awesome. I'd like to tell you that it was not an easy journey, and it's important that I share this part with you, because so many of us are afraid to go for our dreams because we're afraid we're going to fail. You know, we're afraid not only that we won't get all the support we need, but we're afraid we're going to fail. And I just need you to know that the journey is not always easy and smooth. There are bumpy roads along the way, but you keep showing up anyway. It took me 3 tries before I got through the bar, before I actually became a lawyer. I sat for the bar and I failed it, one time after another. And finally, I passed the New York bar on my 3rd try. And it was one of the most incredible things for me, because again, I used to pay lawyers a fortune to keep me out of jail, you know, and the fact that I was then able to do this myself was just incredible. I wanted to say that life has changed drastically for me in the last few years. I am now going for another goal. I'm doing writing. I'm doing a lot of things right now. I have just started to create the vision for myself that I really, really want in my life. Being a lawyer, or becoming a lawyer, was one of the best things I could have ever done, because it gave me the confidence that I needed as a woman that I didn't have. It gave me the credibility that for me I wanted, and I proved that I could do it. That's the truth. I'd like to tell you it was another reason, really, but you know what? I became a lawyer to prove that I could do it. And I did it. I did it. I proved that I have a brain. I proved that I could do all that stuff. And now I believe my charge on this earth is to be of service, because that's what I like to do. To be of service. When I was newly sober, I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of my recovery. And on that list, you would have found a litany of every single material thing I lost. You would have found fur coats and diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos. That's what you would have found. You would have never once found those intangibles that I so value today. Those things that none of you can take away from me unless I give it up. Things like self-esteem. The genuine kind for this alcoholic woman that comes from walking through fear. See, every time I do something I'm afraid of, like standing in front of a group speaking, it's a little check next to my name. And when I do it, I then get the courage to do something else I was afraid to do. And before you know it, I'm doing all these things I never thought possible. So you find self-esteem on my list today, and you find courage. You know, you find courage. Because even though I feel frightened most of the time, I'm a courageous woman. Because I have a faith that is so powerful and so strong that when I can't do it for myself, my little smart feet just go walking. They just go walking. On that list, you'd find a faith that works under all conditions. You'd find God on my list. And I was an agnostic when I got sober, and today I'm a believer. And it doesn't matter today what I choose to call it. Today it's my creator, but it's mine. And the God in my life today is loving and firm, because that's what I need. I need a God that's inclusive, that doesn't just love white people or black people or women or men or gays or straights. A God that loves everyone. And that's the God that I have in my life today, that loves everyone. The God in my life has so much room here. I mean, everyone can step right in. On that list, what you'd also find is my mom. You know, and for me, that's a major switch for me. I like some of you. I heard you today. I came in hating my mother. I can't even begin to explain to you how much I hated my mother when I got sober. People would tell me I looked like her and I wanted to just die. You know, they tell me I sounded like her on the phone. I felt they had stuck a dagger in my throat. I hated this woman with a passion. And at 2 years sobriety, with the help of my sponsor, I had to make some amends to my mom. Because you see, for all those years, I kept complaining that my mother had never been the best mother that she could possibly be. It never dawned upon me that I was never the best daughter. It never dawned upon me that as I was expecting her to understand that I was only human, I was expecting her to be perfect. See, she couldn't dare make a mistake, but yet she better always know and understand when I made a mistake. I treated my mother like garbage, and I expected her to treat me like a queen. And you know, there had to be a lot of healing that took place in there, a lot of healing. And I can tell you another thing that what I realized, and this is just for myself, it was an imperative that I clean that up with my mother. Because until I did, I was incapable of having a healthy relationship with anybody, any man or woman. Because it was always me, my mother, and them. She always got in the way until I cleaned it up. And today my mother's one of my best friends. I didn't plan it that way. You know, when I graduated from Georgetown, there were voices screaming when we go to get our diplomas. My mother's was the loudest voice in the room. You know, you would have thought the ceiling was going to collapse. And lastly, what you find on that list for me today is the gift of love. You know, I came in here hating everybody. And usually, I hated you for the 2% of the things that separate us. Skin color, religion, and sexual choices. That's like a very small percentage of what makes us separate. And yet, those are the things I glommed onto. You know, skin color, race, and sexual preferences. I hated people. And it didn't matter what the reason was. I would always come up with a reason. And today, again, this God that's in my life is very inclusive. And my God has taught me to have an open heart. You know, my greatest charge for this year has been to treat people better than they treat me. And that's been a really difficult task, but that has been the charge that I've given to myself. I always treated you like you treated me. And if you treated me mean, I came back with a zinger. You know, but today, and it's been very difficult, but my charge has been to treat you better than you treat me. I just want to say I am so grateful to be sober. You know, when I got sober, I thought it was only about not drinking one day at a time or not using drugs. I never thought that I would become the kind of woman that walks with the kind of dignity that I do today. I never, ever, in my wildest imaginings, thought that I would be who I am. In closing, I'd like to read something from conference-approved literature in case there are any AA purists sitting in the room. This is my favorite book. I usually travel with my own, and I left it in the hotel room. My book is so torn apart. I've had it since I was brand spanking new. Ansel Seated is my most favorite book. This with the 12 and 12. And I'll tell you, my sponsor got me into this book when I was really new because I was always angry. Always angry. And I like to say it's because my face was in a pissed-off position. You know? It was. So she suggested I read everything in here under anger and resentment. And then she suggested I read everything in here under gratitude and love. And I fell in love with this book. I fell in love with it as I've fallen in love with you. And so I always like to end my talk with this passage on page 4, and it's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings. That these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And that is probably the greatest gift in my sobriety, the gift of choice. And that's just for me. I believe I even have the choice to drink if I want to. I can go right out there and pick up the drink if I want. But I choose not to. The healthier side of me gives me the power to choose to do the right thing. And you tell me that it doesn't matter where I've come from. It doesn't matter what color my skin is. It doesn't matter whether I believe in God or I don't. But the only thing that matters today in the overall scheme of things is where I'm headed. It's where I'm going. And you've taught me that what matters is how I treat each one of you, my fellow travelers, along the way. Not just in AA meetings, but how do I treat you outside? How do I treat you in traffic? You know? How do I treat you on the line in the supermarket? How do I treat you at home? How do I treat you at home? Do I treat my spouse like garbage and yet my sponsee's okay? You know? How do I treat you? That's what you've given me. And all you've ever asked of me in the years that I am sober, all you have ever asked of me is that I always be willing to pass it on. And for that I'm grateful. Thank you.
I'm a terrible singer.
Okay. Last off, getting verbal, where we can hold hands around the room, and if you need the words, if you don't have words, or you want to share them, please, I can share them with someone else. But if not, Laura has them right there. Laura has words right there and over there. Raise your hand if you need the words. Over here. Does anybody need the word? Raise your hand. Oh, this looks good. Okay, this song is for all of us. And we've had a really long day. It's been a really wonderful day. But it's been a long one, and so we're going to make this a little bit shorter than how it's written. We're going to leave out the refrain after 'Twas Grace that taught, and then Through Many Dangers. So we'll be singing Amazing Grace, then 'Twas Grace, Through Many Dangers, When We've Been Here, and then Amazing Grace again. Okay? That's like five. I don't want you all to sing with your whole soul and your whole heart. It doesn't matter what your voice is like, but you're not singing about your voice, you're singing about your soul. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Grace appear me.